No one pronounced Jerusalem's Lot dead on the morning of February 6th. No one knew it was. By and large, the town, not knowing it was dead, would go off to their jobs with no inkling of what lay ahead.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, Stephen King Retrospective.
Yeah, it looks like a fucking party.
Join Garrett.
You can do nothing against the master.
Matt.
Who, me?
And Adam.
I don't want your blood.
But we want your flesh.
As they review all adaptations of King's second novel, Salem's Lot.
You kids ought to know better than to be speeding around Jerusalem's Lot at night.
All the way through the brand new version produced by James Wan and directed by Gary Dauberman.
I'm not leaving.
Continue coming back as the boys continue looking at all the popular authors' on-screen adaptations in publication order.
I'd love to.
So get away from that window.
Look at me, teacher.
The Salem's Lot retrospective begins. Now.
Do yourself a favor. Stay clear.
Salem's Lot 2024 was released October 3rd, 2024, and this was directed by Gary Dauberman. Matt, did we ever think this fucker would get released? We did this series 2 years ago. We were trying to lead up to a theatrical release of this. Evil Dead Rises was released instead, and we were told, oh, it'll come out in 2023. Didn't happen. Did you ever think we'd see it?
No, which is why I kept taking it off the schedule. Because the original release date was September 9th, 2022. Then they delayed it to April because of Evil Dead Rise. They punted it again. Look, if they were going to cancel Batgirl and just not release that, then I thought they would have just done this as a tax write-off, and we'd never see it again. So the fact that this, I told you, I will put this back in the schedule if a trailer ever comes out. And then the trailer came out 2 weeks before it premiered on Max, and I said, all right, that's all the proof I need, although they're kind of a little close as far as time, because we got a lot of shit to cover.
Yeah, because the three of us have our own little discussion group, and in that discussion group, the three of us are like, have we seen anything about this? And all of us are like, no. Even me, the King fan, like, I'm in a ton of Stephen King groups. Nothing was coming out about it. There was no image whatsoever. We got, like, one image of them by the house, and that was it. And then, like you said, they amped it up about 2-3 weeks before it even started airing. It's been on the shelf that long. Adam, sir, did you think we'd ever see this?
Yeah, because it's Stephen King. But I did not think, the way that this thing was delayed, I did not think it would get a theatrical release. This kind of went the way that I thought, especially with the way that they've done so much on Max. So I'm not surprised, but I didn't know if they would sell it to another service. Netflix is buying up other stuff to stream. So is even Tubi. Everything got dumped on Tubi because they're at least doing ads and stuff like that. So I'm not surprised, especially when it's a cast of not really anybody. Stephen King's name still has cachet for some of you. Eh. I'm kidding. But there's something that came out recently that was a massive success that people still talk about. And I think the success of Midnight Mass made sure this was going to see the light of day.
Well, King made sure this saw the light of day because back last year, Dauberman slipped him a copy of this.
And a Mickey.
And King raved about it. He told the studio, look, you've released way worse things based on my work. Why is this thing still sitting on the shelf? And that was when they got the ball rolling. And here we are. Now, we were told, like Matt said, it was going to be theatrical. But Max, instead of doing that, just decided to just put this on their streaming service. And here we are. Let's start with this. Gary Dauberman. Now, he was partly responsible for the big groundswell that became the third or fourth win of King fandom. Because, Matt, he wrote the two It movies, right?
Oh, he's one of several writers worked on that script. I mean, the fact that there was like so many writers on that movie and it went through all the director changes, it's amazing that movie was as coherent as it was. But yeah, he was involved in that. He was also, he's been involved in the James Wan Conjuring universe. He wrote all the Annabelle movies.
Yep, he directed the last one.
I do know he was one of the writers on Swamp Thing, which did give me some hope, because I like that show a
lot. Same here.
But doing this, another adaptation, because we've done two before, technically three if you include the sequel, which is its own beast entirely. Mm. My question was why take another stab at this? Because when I look at adaptations, I like getting to the giving a second coat of paint on the ones that have done it like drastically wrong. And I have issues with both Salem's Lot's adaptations, but I don't think either of them are terrible. And those had the luxury of being 3+ hours. This was, I knew they were going to have to truncate it somewhat, but when I saw the runtime was 1 hour and 45 minutes, I was like, uh-oh. Because I've seen the size of that book, and based on that metric, I'm like, there's no way they're going to adapt all of it.
Well, guess what? Unsurprisingly, his first cut was 3 hours. And they had him cut it that much. So that's a lot. I mean, you're cutting an hour plus out of it. The official runtime is about 1 hour 57. But
yeah, with credits. But also
with credits. Yeah.
In the same way last time I talked about being jokered out, I'm kind of done with vampires for a little while. At least until Nosferatu comes out, then I'm back in.
Because
that movie looks amazing. But I already had my fill of vampires this year with Abigail, which I loved.
Yes.
That I kind of didn't want to see another take on classical vampirism, especially another adaptation of something that I've seen 7.5 hours of over the last 2+ years.
Now, Adam, as the non-King fan on this podcast, were you looking forward to watching this at all?
I've gotten better recently. Mm-hmm. I thought they did a decent job with the trailer, you know, when that came out. Though, apparently they spent as much money to get the rights for the song Sundown as they did on anything else, because, man, they used that like a son of a bitch in the trailer. But I thought the trailer looked competent. I thought it was interesting, and it had some spooky vibes to it. That some of the shots made me think of Fright Night, you know, in the way that it was done. So, and they dropped that trailer. I was like, okay, it looks like there's something here worth seeing. And then I saw the runtime, and I went, hey, you get to watch a review movie. It's got a decent run length. So I was in for it. I was like, you know what? Show me what you got. Yeah, it's only going to be streaming, but you know what? That saves me a lot of time and money. Sure, let's see it. I do think this is a story that's ripe for adaptation. You know, I do think there's something here. And you know what? I recently read Jerusalem's Lot because I worked my way through night shift. So,
yeah.
Hey, I got that little short story out of the way, which it plays into the opening credits, I guess.
Yeah,
But yeah, I was ready for this.
Now, I had to get myself ready for it, boys, and in order to do that, I went back. You know, we did those reviews over 2 years ago at this point, so I sat down and I watched the 1979 TV series, and I watched the 2004 remake with Rob Lowe. I skipped The Return of Salem's Lot because, as Matt said, that's its own little thing. But what I'll say about those, and we did do reviews of it, check our archives. We have reviews of those on the site. But, you know, I think the Tobe Hooper version gets the mood right. I think everything about that Tobe Hooper movie is all about the mood and the creepy factor. And I think the 2004 version gets the story beats pretty much right. But I'm with both of you where I looked at this, I said, why? Now, James Wan apparently had a choice between this and the Tommyknockers. Matt, I don't know if you've read the Tommyknockers, but I think he kind of went for the better property at least, right?
I've never read Tommyknockers. I've seen the ABC series. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one I'm more interested. I would be more interested in doing that because that one's only been done once. Someone else took another stab at Salem's Lot in 2004. Mm-hmm. But you're kind of like picking at the corpse again. And it's like, what more do you have to say? Especially when I heard this was going to take place in the 70s.
Yeah. Which Dauberman does. I mean, he did that with Annabelle, too.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. You can tell Annabelle's set in the 70s based on the frickin' hairstyles.
Yep, that was how much I was looking forward to it, where I was just like, you know what? They've done it. We've done it twice. Like, there's no reason to. But you know what? I mean, if you're trying to appeal to people who are coming into King for the first time, then I guess, as King said, he's just said, well, you've done worse, so just put it out.
Yeah, that should not be the reason, though. Well, we've made worse, so we got to put this out no matter what.
Exactly. And by the way, King's name is on here as executive producer, so maybe he had other factors involved, too.
Sure. Well, there's also the other thing of this one is the first feature film adaptation because the other two were made for television.
Yeah, that's true.
I still think there is a certain divide. It's much smaller than it used to be of TV versus film. Now the lines have gotten so blurred.
You know, to your point, so for the Tommyknockers, it still says in development, so that may end up seeing the light of day one day.
Well, yeah, but not with Juan's name attached to it, though.
Well, Juan's got coming out next year, The Monkey Man or whatever it's called.
Oh, yep. That looks... Oh, God, I saw the trailer for that. Oh, fuck. I can't wait for that, actually. I'm pretty excited because that story scared the shit out of me as a kid. So we start off with a haunting theme and the old school New Line Cinema logo. Adam, did you pop for that? I did.
I popped huge. I was like, yeah. I was like, all right, give me back to Elm Street. Here we go.
Right?
I did not know that New Line even existed, you know, the way that they've been treated recently. So if they were to use this as an imprint, that'd be a nice way to go. I like this.
The opening credits are displayed while we're seeing headlines and red blood being seeped through a map. So for those not familiar with Salem's Lot, this at least gives you something to go off of.
I guess. But when I saw the New Line logo, I got my bitch counter all set, ready to go. Then I realized, oh, it's not a Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
Nope. Now, Adam, I mean, you at this point are well-versed in Salem's Lot. We covered this series a couple years ago. But if you were coming in brand new, I mean, this would be something to go off of, right?
It would be. It introduces enough. It does a little bit. It's funny. I feel like I'm watching opening credits for like House of the Dragon. You know, we're connecting blood. But this is a lot of the, if you read the short stories I recently did, people, for Jerusalem's Lot, you get the letters sent back and forth between the characters. And you see some of those here in the opening credits. I thought this was it was a nice opening. It's creepy. I like the mood music. It's setting me off all right here. It's a good way to start.
We're in Barlow and Straker's furnishing shop, where Straker tells Snow to pick up a shipment and deliver it to his new home, the one on the hill known as the Marsden House. And I'm going to get this out of the way right now. A big part of that book. Now, I wanted to go back to the book. I wanted to read the book again. I couldn't. There was too much going on. I did get the miniseries viewings in. But one thing I remember about the book, and even the Hooper version touched on this a little bit. Vampires are just a small part of what haunts this town. Like, it's all about this house. The killings being done here, the car accidents, everything spawns from this house. And one thing this movie does not get right is this house is not a part of this story, hardly at all.
The house isn't a character like it was in the Toby Hooper one. And also, you don't get the sense that Salem's Lot had anything dirty or sinister about it until the vampires moved in. Like the last line of The Lost Boys. Santa Clara was fine until all the damn vampires showed up. Whereas in the book and in both versions, this house was the site of horrors. And that's why the main character, or at least the quote-unquote main character, because it's kind of different in this one, returns to the homestead to kind of revisit those demons. But I have a problem with this opening because the guy who plays Straker is fucking horrible. His accent goes in and out. There's parts where he sounds Southern. There's parts where he sounds like a cartoon British man. And I questioned this being the entry point for the story.
Yeah, me too. I read this. There was a prologue starring Derek Mears, who was Jason Voorhees in the Friday the 13th remake. There was a whole prologue of how Straker came to be. And I think we need that. I'm with you. I think this is a weird entry point into this story, which would have added to the runtime, obviously. But Adam, how'd you feel about where we started here?
First, I was like, okay, you know what? I recognized this. I recognized Straker. And so I'm like, okay, this is familiar territory. It's a different entry point. I mean, this is going to be considerably shorter than everything else we've seen before because it's not a miniseries. So you better get going right away. And what I'm struck by is, okay, we're getting the introduction. We're getting a coffin. We're getting the house. So the house is going to be important. To both of y'all's point, kind of let down because no, it isn't. It's a choice, and I think it's a choice for time, but it changes what this movie is in relation to the story, is from what I understand it. You know, it's not about Salem's Lot. It's about the damn vampires. So I'm okay with it. I actually like Straker because I do think his being all over the place may be a part of him traveling, you know, with the vampires for so long. But I'm intrigued right off the bat. And it's different, familiar territory that I'm okay with.
I was also bothered by his side profile gives him such a strong resemblance to Henry Cavill. That I would have rather seen, especially with the mustache. Like, he looks like Cavill from Mission Impossible. I kind of wish Henry Cavill played the character. Because it's not in line with, you get James Mason and Donald Sutherland to this guy.
And You know what? You might as well put this on a loop, because I'm going to be saying it a lot on this podcast. But one thing this movie does not do also, what it does is it truncates everything. Meaning we have no time to process exactly what we're seeing. Or we have no time to process what these characters are feeling. This movie goes at a pace where I felt like that 79 film, while I have seen people say, well, it's boring, it takes too long, it's a good argument for added runtime, because we get some character development. Now, some people argue it's too much character development. And I saw that, you know, in viewing it again this week, I did notice, I mean, there are some times where it kind of drags a bit. It gets a little boring. And, you know, you got to go 2-3 commercial breaks before you get a fucking vampire in that. So I get that. But at the same time, I don't think there's anything that lingers here for you to actually process what's going on. And that's a problem.
It's a problem if this is going to be 2.5 hours. It's not, though. And I think that's it's a miniseries to movie difference.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. We then see the van pull up to pick up the shipment. So this does set a haunting mood, right, Matt?
It does, but it also shows one of the flaws of the movie is that because the characterizations are really truncated, they have to give a lot of exposition and backstory through dialogue. Because the guy driving talks about like the history of the house, because the movie cut the prologue that was supposed to set that up. And one thing that I also don't like, I hate this day-night filter that permeates a lot of this movie. It looks like a frickin' Snapchat filter through a lot of it and makes it feel more TV-centric.
Although there are some good shots here. I mean, we're going to see a death later where I thought it was shot pretty well. We do get some shots, but yeah, I'm with you where it gets kind of distracting sometimes. They enter a sea of red and pick up the shipment. They drop the coffin, which opens, and we see it packed with dirt. They carry it a little ways longer until they hear a crackling voice that tells them to come closer, but their temptations are tempered and they just leave without taking the shipment.
So this is also here for the purpose of condensation, because we need to see that Barlow can manipulate people even if they're not vampires.
Yes.
To explain something that happens later on. It's also a mistake to show him this early.
Well, they don't really show him. They show him in shadow. We don't get a full view of him yet.
You got a freeze flash, don't you?
I didn't catch that. All I saw was a shadow, but...
No, they do like the light goes on and you see his full face, then it says Salem's Lot, which they couldn't even come up with a new design for Barlow. They just did the 79 one again, except he's got the filter from I Am Legend Vampires.
All right, let's get to Barlow now since you bring it up. Dauberman is a huge fan of the 79 original. And in fact, he said in an interview I read that I can't believe they made this, that he has a action figure of Barlow from that film. Still to this day. You know what? I like the fact that they go back to this, because in watching the 2004 version, they tried the suave thing that King did in his novel, and I didn't think it worked very well. I think having him be the background monster is perfect for when we see him, and when he comes out, you have an opportunity to do some scares. The problem is that he's not in it enough. He's just kind of there.
No. That purely monster type of vampire doesn't work because Straker is also barely in this movie.
Well, that's true too, and that comes with the truncation of this film. The more you truncate it, the more you take away the importance of these characters. And I'm with you. Like, I don't think that they're a big enough part of this story.
So I'm glad they kept a look but updated it a little bit, because I do think he's a pretty fearsome looking vampire, and I think he doesn't look as corny as he did in the original. I do think he's got a good fearsome to him. I noticed the image of him here right away, but that's also because I hit rewind like 3 times. I was like, did they just, ooh, yeah, they did. Ooh, yeah, they did. And then I paused the movie. So I had to do something I can't do in a theater.
Yeah.
I like the update, and I like keeping it classical, but with a little more fearsome. Later on in the movie, I do feel, to Matt's point, I feel we go a little I Am Legend, Blade 2 with some of the look of it, and I've gotten tired of that. But I dig it. I like what they're doing here. This opening, like, 5 to 10 minutes, it's got me hooked in more than the other ones have.
Interesting. To go to Matt's point, though, this does, to me, feel more like a preview to Nosferatu, which we're going to be getting in a couple months. You know?
It does. It does.
Yeah.
But I do think, by putting this out the way it is, by the people involved with this movie, and the fact that it's not put out as Stephen King's Salem's Lot, which is traditionally what you see, I think they're trying to sell this to the generation below us, and that's a different type of movie making, different type of show. And I think that's why this is being done the way that it is.
I have plenty of things to say about that as we get deeper in the film. But I think you're absolutely right.
I'm not saying that's good or bad at this point, but I do think that's the reasoning that some of this is being cut and shifted around already.
Speaking of cut, we cut to Ben Mears, played by Lewis Pullman, who, goddamn, is a dead ringer for his dad. We saw this guy briefly when we did Top Gun 2 a couple years ago. Cop comes to his window and asks if he's lost. Ben says no, he's just sightseeing, and the officer notices books in his car and asks if he's an author, and then tells him not to cause too much trouble, as if he does, the sheriff will have to get to work. Lewis Pullman. This is a character who was a big part of those previous two entries. I was not a big fan of David Soul in the first film. Rob Lowe was kind of terrible too as this character. He's more of a background character in this movie. He takes kind of a back seat here.
Yeah, that's what I was alluding to. Like, really, Mark is more of the main character and certainly the one with the most agency, anybody. But I think that's also by design because the movie's so cut down. Other people have to tell you Ben's backstory, not himself. And it's also weird seeing William Sadler show up in a Stephen King adaptation that's not directed by Frank Darabont.
Yep.
Because he's in three of them.
Yeah, he is. We then hear the opening verse to Sundown by Gordon Lightfoot as we see that famous Salem's Lot sign, and he drives on.
There's something really cool seeing Jerusalem's Lot faded to Salem's Lot.
Yeah.
The way that's framed, the way the camera pulls in on it, that set up the next part a little nicely.
And again, this does take place in the 70s, so that's the exact aesthetic he's going for. And I like that, you know, in watching the 79 version a few hours before this one, I did like that they didn't change that too much. We see a car that looks suspiciously like Christine getting worked on. Nice little reference there. And some more of the daily happenings in this town, which, true to form, isn't much. This is a small town that's not getting much action.
I like that he is enjoying what it is. It feels like it's a town that went back in time. I'm going to say, though, I feel like I'm watching a movie set in the 70s that was made in the 80s.
Interesting.
You know, if that makes sense. That's kind of how I feel. And I'm going to start it right here, though, with a comparison. This was done in Midnight Mass, with a character returning to a town that was kind of set in its way, set in the time, driving through it. That was done only a few years ago. It was done by a filmmaker who has done a lot of Stephen King adaptations and is doing more. There's going to be a lot of people comparing the two for very good reasons, because that show is Salem's Lot. Enough that I'm surprised Stephen King didn't sue him, maybe only because he's the one
well,
person making good
at it.
Well, that's the thing. It's because he's making good adaptations of King's work.
Mm-hmm. And knowing King, he revels in that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He's found his new McGarris.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good point.
He really has.
Yes.
That by planning it actually makes good versions.
We see Ben enter what he thinks is going to be his place to rent as Susan is reading his book, trying to decide whether to finish it or not, and Larry Crockett walks in. This is when we hear someone has bought the Marsden house. Susan hears the name Ben Mears and mentions someone else might have a few rooms open. So she's not really open to having this guy around, although she plays a bigger part in this than we've seen in previous versions, right, Matt?
Yeah, that's to the detriment, because these two have no chemistry whatsoever. And also, I love the little in-joke where if you look at his author's shot on the back cover of the book, Stephen King has that exact same pose on my copy of Misery.
Yeah, he does. Good catch. He settles into his room, and we cut to Stanley Elementary, another King reference.
What is that directly referencing?
Stanley Hotel from The Shining.
Oh, okay.
This is when we meet Mark Petrie, played by Jordan Preston Carter. He beats up a bully, and you know what I like about this scene? It displays how kids talk without going full Rob Zombie.
You know what I don't like about this scene? Because I feel like all he did was rewrite what he already wrote in It.
Well, this was his second book, Adam.
No, I'm not talking about Stephen King. I mean,
you're talking about Dauberman.
Over and over and over. I'm talking about Dauberman. I'm like, dude, you did this already. To the T, to the race, to the chubby kid beating up. I mean, this, I might as well have turned on It on Max instead of Salem's Lot. I can't believe how bad. Stephen King ate Stephen King, but Dauberman is also now aping himself, aping King. I'm like, oh my God, I'm enjoying it until we got back into retread territory.
Well, that's the problem also. If you've seen one Stephen King bully, you've seen them all.
Yeah. And this is directly from the book.
I also love how this bully has such pull that even the teacher's like, I'm not standing up to that kid. You kidding me? He runs the school. I think he took the teacher's milk money.
All right. So let's get to Mark Petrie and let's get to It. It's funny you mentioned that, Adam, because...
Forget the it, yeah.
Well, no, because I want to make a comparison here. I think a lot of the truncatedness of this movie is the producer saying that It movie from a few years ago, that did very well business, and the first part was the best, and that concentrated on the kids. So we're going to concentrate more on the kids in this. I do like Mark Petrie in this. They did switch out the race. They did other things with him. But he's going to do things in this movie that I would have never imagined a kid would do. Look, I like what they do with this. I think it gives it a better focus, I thought. Adam, what'd you feel about the Mark Petrie character and the fact that this is kind of aping off It?
It completely apes off of It. I'm surprised that they didn't decide to do this movie in a part one, part two, because yeah. I think, It is written and designed that way, but I think you could do this movie, and I think there's a end point that you could continue, and it would be all right. I like it, but... It happens at the expense of Ben Mears. It happens at the expense of others. I like what they do with Mark. The connections to others and the characterizations of everybody coming together is very choppy, sloppy, and rough. You needed some smoother ways to make them come together because it's just almost everything is by happenstance and tripping over each other. But I like Mark. It's amazing that you get a strong child character just because he is. There's nothing else. He stands up for himself, and good for him.
I like the actor. I think there are certain things that the character does where he has no reaction to it that kind of bothers me, and then he does something in the third act where I'm like, are you fucking serious? Like,
he does three things in the third act. You're like, are you fucking serious?
Several. There was one that was literally my breaking point where it kind of jumped the shark. Adam, I think we're watching a Blade prequel.
Oh, this my God. Yeah. You know what? By the time Blade gets made, he's going to be old enough to be the Darkstalker.
Matt Burke pulls them off each other, and I feel a lot of why King is endorsing this movie is because this character is wearing a Red Sox jacket.
That might be King's personal jacket he told him to put on before.
Yeah, exactly. And Richie says he better watch his back, and he then tells Petrie, next time someone says uncle, you let them go, as everyone goes by their word at the lot. We cut to Straker glancing out the window as Ben's writing and researching away. See, it's told in the description of this movie that Ben's here to research a book and write a book. I don't really get that from this because, again, we're not seeing a lot of these developments that we saw previously.
We're not seeing him do any research for a book. We're not seeing him write a book. We're not seeing him. I mean, you know what? He's the Jar Jar Martin of getting a book written. He says he's going to write it, but it ain't ever going to happen. Ben Mears is going to finish his book the same time that, Winds of Winter gets done. Shit. If we weren't told upon his introduction that he was here for a book, we would never know. Because it comes up like in a 10-second scene later, it never comes up again.
Nope.
You know, kind of like the Mears house being a place of evil. It's a dropped line and it doesn't matter. And either include it or don't, but it's a shame because it's forgotten.
Marston House, by the way.
Okay.
It's also the thing, like, again, the mom and Susan have to give all the exposition rather than him explaining why he's actually there. And they're in a library, and they're having the loudest fucking conversation.
All right, so let's talk about that scene. Susan heads to the library with her mom, who tells her to give the boy another chance. And this, of course, is another character who... This character, who was kind of a big part of that first miniseries, he's barely in this. And as you mentioned, Matt, he is rather older. They are then told Ben's backstory as he's in the library as well. Susan says she's going to the drive-in. So there's a way to get Ben to go in a little meet-cute. We cut to a Dracula figure on a nightstand as Danny tells Petrie that he needs to watch his back when it comes to Richie.
All right, Petrie, either of you recognize Danny?
No, I did not.
So that is the twin brother of the kid who plays Homelander's son on The Boys.
Oh, shit.
I thought it was the boy. I thought it was Homelander's son.
No, it's his twin. It's literally his twin brother.
Oh, Jesus.
Wow.
Damn, he looks the same.
Well, I thought Nelson it was twin. Too, because this movie was shot like 3 years ago.
Petrie tells a Houdini legend as they decide to head out. We cut to the drive-in as Susan once again runs into Ben. They have a conversation about how Ben had come here for research and that he used to live here as a kid. Susan tells him she has a secret spot with a much better view if he wanted to join her.
That really, and as you meant, they're just on top of the fucking projector house where everybody can see them.
And Matt, to your point, these two have zero fucking chemistry. We cut to Danny and Ralph as they're being asked by Stryker if they need a ride. The kids turn them down and keep moving, or do they?
He should have been holding out a paper boat.
You're not kidding. In a white van.
Yeah, and had candy on the side. But also, the kids leave because it's going to be sundown. That's not enough time because they have to walk like 8 miles to get to their house, apparently.
Meanwhile, Susan gives Ben a big rundown of who's who in the town as she says that she's trying to get her real estate license and that she plans to move to Boston right afterward.
Because I'm going to be a pilot someday.
He replies with how he's researching for his new story and that his parents died in a car accident when he was 9. Again, another plot point that pretty much just gets dropped.
I also don't remember that. Is that mentioned in the book?
Yes.
For such a small town where everybody knows each other, yeah, that would be known.
It would be. As somebody who's lived in a small town, I can vouch for that. They know everything about everybody in these fucking towns.
It would be news that Mears came back.
I also thought they were going to mention that the reason why Father Callahan was in jail is because he got a DUI and he was the one who ran over his parents.
See, that's just it. We don't really get an idea of who did it. We just know that his parents died in a car accident. You know, I thought maybe with how Susan's mom reacts to him, I thought maybe it was her. They would wrap it around like that, but they don't, thank God. The camera for the movie starts and Dauberman chooses to use a close-up on it to close the scene. We cut back to Danny and Ralph as there's a scary shot of Ralph just getting abducted. He's taken in a bag to the house as Stryker says the master needs a sacrifice. We get a bit of shaky cam, which stops, and we cut to a POV shot as Barlow approaches, grabs him, and says, "Let's feast."
These kids walking on the hill through the woods, the way that it's shot and everything else, I'm a fan of the way this is. There's something quaint about it. It feels very, very soundstagey.
Mm-hmm.
This entire movie feels like it's shot in a soundstage.
Yes.
But the way that that look is, I don't know, it's almost like an old Spielberg shot. Like, you just got a hill, they're walking, the camera's panning, and you see Stryker coming up behind. Like, I like the way this is shot, the way this kidnapping is done. It's a good sense of foreboding. It's a nice shot. I enjoy it quite a bit.
And I like they don't dwell on it. You know, when we talked about Dr. Sleep those years ago, there's a really harrowing scene with a kid in that movie. I'm glad they didn't really go that route here. We're seeing it and we're hearing Barlow utter "Let's feast," so we know what's going to happen here, but at the same time, it's not like we're going to stay on it for very long.
I also like hearing Barlow just those whispers. There's mm-hmm. something hauntingly terrifying about it. It's a nice point.
Yeah, and I like that Stephen King is apparently the only person who's still unafraid to kill children on screen.
Well,
absolutely.
He's on as an executive producer. He's not a director on this. I will say 2024 King would not do this.
But even like 2017, the It movie, like you clearly see
his
arm get bit off.
That was written in 1986, though. These are things that we're going to get to eventually. I mean, hell, he kills the main kid in Cujo. You know, he was not afraid to kill kids back then.
Yeah, but they changed that for the movie. But also I thought for sure this was PG-13 until that scene happened. And I'm like, oh, this has to be rated R.
Oh, we're going to get a scene in a hospital here, which really made that rating known.
Oh, the scene that made me laugh my ass off.
The one that King said, "Beware of the hospital scene. It'll blow your mind." He tweeted about it. We'll get there. We cut to the next day as Father Callahan is woken up by William Sadler's sheriff character. As you mentioned, Matt, here he is again in a King adaptation. We cut to Ben hitching a ride on the back of a pickup as Burke tells Ben about Floyd Tibbetts and then tells him that his books are better than critics have led the public to believe.
Tell that to Stanley Kubrick.
Danny is taken to a car and Ben says, "Sometimes your brain will let you remember when terrible things happen." Ben takes Susan home as her mom just glares, and Susan says that she's doing this because her mom's worried that the two of them would run off together, to which Ben replies, "That doesn't sound too bad." Oof.
I hate the fact they're written like they're teenagers.
I know. I do too.
Yeah.
No, nobody is aware that they're both in their 30s.
We cut to Danny waking up and looking out the window as he thinks he hears Ralphie. He walks outside and tries to spot him in the fog. I do like how the filmmakers make this set look. As Danny is glancing around, there's a jacket hung that looks like a bat, and suddenly things are constantly out of focus in the fog. I think this does a good job of setting up the mood you want while watching a horror film. Adam, I'm assuming you think so too.
I do It's obvious to me that it's made, this was supposed to be theatrical, but I feel like it's being made on a TV budget. I feel like I'm on a soundstage, but with that said, I think they've done a good enough job of setting a good atmosphere.
I would say, yeah, this is pretty cool as far as, I don't want to say dream logic, but it's kind of like a dreamlike state with the fog and the seesaw. It's just the first, you can tell this was made in the 70s because you haven't seen a seesaw in God knows how long if you walk outside.
And it's surprising that this is produced by James Wan, because we haven't really discussed the Saw movies. I know somebody on this podcast really wants to. We'll get to eventually. But those movies aren't about mood. Like, those movies are so in your face. And even the Conjuring movies, like a lot of those, it's all about sound effects and how loud the ghosts get in those movies. Here, Dauberman's trying to set a mood, and I do like that. Danny moves forward some more, and as Matt says, we see a seesaw moving, and then Danny is picked up into the sky. His mom wakes up to see him right in front of her saying he feels sick. We cut to a doctor's office as the doctor says Danny has a body deficiency which prevents him from making more red cells. His red cell count is at 40% and it needs to be around 80 to 85.
So he has, like, what, sickle cell anemia?
Yeah, that's what they say, yeah. More movement within the hospital room as his mom once again wakes up. When she goes to get him a drink of water, he takes down the blood vial and splatters his own face as he tries drinking it like a Capri Sun.
I couldn't take this seriously.
Yeah.
I literally burst out laughing because it's not enough that the visual is absurd. They go so overboard with the amount of blood that's in that IV bag.
I know.
And then they do the overhead shot where it looks like he just downed an entire thing of cherry Kool-Aid, which makes it look even worse.
It works for shock value. Yeah, to the point you start chuckling a little bit, but it's a shocking moment.
We cut to the cemetery, and we get one of the weirdest cuts I've ever seen in a movie, as we're seeing a Bible being opened, and we cut immediately to a peanut butter and jelly sandwich being opened.
I don't understand this, because it doesn't either. Come back. I don't
no.
get it. Somebody in the editing room fell asleep.
Yeah, clearly there was 20 minutes of footage that was meant to be in between these two transitions.
Yes! We cut to another famous scene from the previous movies, that of the boys being covered in dirt as pounding occurs and Danny tries making his way out. But when the coffin is open, the boy is not moving. But when Mike comes back to it, the coffin is open and the boy attacks. Again, this was a scene, and I mentioned this in the first podcast. As I was reading the book, I'm just imagining this kid looking at him, and he cannot get out of his mind that this kid, even though he's supposedly dead, is eyeing him and looking at him. So I do feel that, but again, I talked about mood earlier. This is just kind of there and it just moves along.
Yeah, and also I was shocked when I found out who the actor is. That blew my mind. That's the little boy from Unbreakable.
Oh shit, is it?
Yeah, that plays the
oh my god.
I mean, it makes sense. He literally saw dead people.
Adam, what'd you feel about this scene?
Works for a quick moment of horror, but to your point, you don't get a chance to linger and be enveloped in it, but it's creepy. It does its job that way.
It also plays, though, like a comedic beat because it cuts to him after the funeral. It's daytime. And then it cuts to him passed out in a drunken stupor at night, which is also the problem. Like, you don't get to know these characters at all.
Yeah, that's a big problem. Yeah, I had to look up who this guy was because, as you mentioned, we don't really get introduced to the guy.
I did that for the first little bit. Then I stopped. I stopped looking up to see what their names were, who they were. I'm like, if it doesn't matter, I'm not going to do the work of the film.
We cut to a class with Ben taking questions, and he's asked if him and Susan are dating. And this is a weird change they made from the book, because in the book and in those other movies, Matt was Ben's teacher. But here, he's just someone he kind of runs into, and they become friends. Why? Because Matt has no friends? What's the reason for this?
I didn't pay attention. I thought they knew each other from his time at the school, just growing up there.
Maybe, but we didn't really get that.
He'd realistically be his teacher if they cast a younger actor to play Ben.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, again, I feel like the script writers wrote this character to be, like, 18 to 20, and then they cast a 30-year-old and said, all right, fuck it, it's good enough. He looks young enough, even though he does not.
We then go to a bar where Burke hears Hurley Gurley Man being played. He approaches Mike Ryerson, who says he thinks he's sick with something. The lighting here with constant shadows. Adam, it makes Mike's face look like the cover of Alice in Chains' album Facelift when I look at this.
It feels cheap. This is when it starts to feel cheap, but it also starts to feel repetitive. You literally just hit the same beat a couple times in a row in a very short amount of time.
Someone tell the bar owner to pay their electric bill.
I know.
They're literally only lighting half of the bar.
Burke says that he'll take Mike to see a doctor in the morning, and he says that he'll take him in until then. Burke notices the puncture wounds on Mike's neck, which he immediately concludes is a vampire. No snakes?
This is where the movie takes a nosedive for me, because there's no slow build to people reconciling with using scientific logic or trying to explain it. It's just, yep, they're vampires and everybody goes with it.
Yeah. And then, you know what? What's weird is King was coming out in the previous month saying, well, you're going to like Salem's Lot because it goes back to the slow buildness of those movies from the 70s and 80s. No, it doesn't. There's no slow build in this whatsoever.
This thing.
Slow build is left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, exactly.
This thing sprints from scene to scene.
Burke lights a pipe in the house as he paces and hears pounding coming from upstairs. When he investigates, he sees shadows move in the room. Burke has to see Ben, who breaks the rules by having Susan over, which I thought was funny. This fucking landlord's in there. She's, you know, she mentioned earlier, well, you can't have any company. And as she's talking to Ben here, she just kind of nonchalantly says, oh, hi, Susan, as she's like hiding in the corner. I thought that was kind of funny. Burke asks Ben for a cross or something of its kind. He tells Ben and Susan what he saw and says that he think it was a creature of the night.
Hooker.
The group go to see Mike, who's laying down and seemingly not breathing. He's also cold to the touch, so they assume he's dead. When Ben approaches him, he leans down and sees the marks on his neck have disappeared. Ben gives Matt a story to tell when he takes the body away in the morning. The doctor comes in and verifies that Mike's dead. Now, this is Alfre Woodward. I think she kind of brings a little bit of levity to this, because this movie is very, very, there's not much comedy in it. As we mentioned, characters don't have any chemistry. We're moving along. But this is the one character who's like, fuck this. Why am I here?
I think Alfre Woodward was saying that because I think she is awful in this movie.
Yeah, but I like some of the lines that her character's given.
Well, there's one line where it's straight out of a Madea Halloween.
Madea.
Which, by the way, Burke, I think Boo and Madea Halloween is scarier than this movie.
There's a couple jump moments here.
Burke asks when she shows up.
Yeah, me too.
She brings some levity to it. I like it, but I also wonder, is this just a finishing out the contract type of deal she had with some of the hit for Warner Brothers? This is such a thankless role she gets, but she hands it up.
Until we see that 3-hour cut, we won't know exactly how big her role originally was. Burke asks what Danny died of, and the question is asked if there is some kind of connection. The doctor says she doesn't have an opinion yet, as she looks down and sees a cross in Ben's hand. And let's talk about this now. There's a decision this movie makes. All of a sudden, crosses are lightsabers.
Yeah, they glow.
Yes. Which is in the spirit of King's book. I get it, but my God, it's so pronounced here. I don't know. I kind of dug it in a weird way.
I think it gets overdone by the end of the film. I think it's kind of cool when you first see it, but if you're going to do that, you need to also have a scene where you have this be your light in the darkness, and it doesn't get used that way. It gets really silly when somebody takes some frickin' tongue depressors, and that seems to work as long as you bind them together. It's a cool effect in a movie that doesn't have a lot of cool effects, so yeah, sure, why not? So somebody made the prop, it looked cool, and they were going to maximize the hell out of it.
Yep. We get to another famous scene from those other movies as Daniel Petrie wakes up to slight knocking on his window. He looks out and sees Ralph on the outside. Dahmer's trying to recreate this really famous scene where, let's face it, this kid was on a chair and they were moving it up and down and there was fog behind it. But that's a scene that people really, really reference when they talk about this movie. Hell, it scared me as a kid. Dahmer's trying his best to recreate it, but I don't think he can do it too effectively. I'm noticing that he can set a mood. He has creepy set pieces, but he's not too good at tension, which this movie desperately needs, right, Matt?
Well, there's no time to build tension because the scenes are so fragmented. And it doesn't help that it's almost, I mean, the shot compositions are almost the same. It's like the same window design. Mm-hmm. It's just so hard to recreate that. I will say, though, it's not as bad as, you know, in the Nightmare on Elm Street remake where Freddy comes through the wall and it looks horrendous.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's not like that. It's a cover of a song where I'm like, yeah, it's fine, but there's no spirit is not there.
Which begs the question, why try it? That's just the big thing about this movie, is you already have these pieces that were done so well in that first film. Why try it? And Nightmare on Elm Street fell into that too, Matt, where we're having him come from the wall. Why recreate that?
I feel like you almost have to do this scene. It's decent. I think the reason that certain things stand out so well in the first one is because they're the only things that stand out in the first one. So you kind of cling to like four or five moments to make that stand out. But to Matt's point, yeah, this thing is racing through it that you don't get a chance to breathe to build up to the next moment. On the bright side, this film's what, $138 with credits, $140?
It's $157. It's almost 2 hours.
Is it that long? Okay, my mistake. But that means it's half as long as the original miniseries. So, yeah, I mean, you can't not do it. That's the thing. But it's fine. It's the definition of, that's fine. It's a decent recreation if you were going
to
do it.
This movie's MO is, let's get to the vampire action. Because, as I mentioned, in that 79 version, yeah, there's a lot of good mood pieces in it and everything, but it takes so long in between vampire kills in that movie. It takes so long between attacks. And here, we're getting it, and we're getting it in full doses. We're getting the red splatter, everything else, but it just doesn't seem too fulfilling because I need that extra 40 minutes of character building in order to care. And I'm not caring about any of this. I'm seeing scenes go through that I've seen done previously and done much better because I cared. I don't care about these characters.
It's also, like, you have to remember back in 79 when the original miniseries came out, we had yet to get to the 80s, which really revitalized vampires, at least on screen. I mean, look at the last decade, how many vampire, like, not just like your Twilights and your sparkly, sexy vampires. We've had stuff like Renfield, we've had Abigail.
What was the one with Ethan Hawke? Day Trippers? What was the
name? Daybreakers.
Daybreakers.
Well, that was a cool one because they found a spin, like, they finally did a world where society is nothing but vampires.
Yeah, that is a good movie.
That movie's really underrated. I wish more people would check it out. But yeah, this, it feels... There's no thing to differentiate it from any other, like, run-of-the-mill. Like, this is basically 30 Days of Night.
Yeah, I thought of that, too, a lot while watching this.
The vampires were actually scary in that movie.
But this is, you want the build-up and the characters, and I agree with you, but you took away the house already, so you limited your focus, because it's not about evil. It is about vampires taking over a town now. It's not about evil in this town.
Yep.
So they fundamentally shifted what this film was going to focus on.
Ralph comes in as Danny puts a cross to his face and promises that he will set him free. He goes through his comic books and learns the rules of vampires. Again, since this movie's so going through it so quick, we're just seeing him open a couple books here. And, I know how to kill vampires now, which I guess is more effective to me than, say, opening up your phone and Googling it.
That's why they wanted to set it in the 70s.
Yep, exactly. We cut to Matt being revisited by Mike. He takes out a cross with lights on it, and Matt is thrown into a wall. And you know what's funny about this? This is another thing. How do you undo an invite? You just say, I retract my invite, and then just put your cross up, and he gets sucked out of the freaking room like there's a fucking airplane right outside the window. Okay.
I was perfectly good with this. I'm like, there you go. You revoke your invitation. Yes, those are vampire rules. Me and the Frog Brothers know this. Yes, this is...
But if you watch Buffy... Oh, never mind.
You... But, so. Yeah, see, but I was glad that they did do that. You had to be invited in, and you had to be revoked. So you're bringing back some classic stuff if you're going to do classic vampires.
The doctor is told that Danny's mom was found dead this morning. They then see that Ryerson's body is now missing. Dr. Cody finds Matt on the ground, and they get together with Ben to go over what Straker and the boys have to do with what is going on in the town.
I like that review when the body's missing from the freezer.
I do too.
Water is just a little levity here and there. She does play a fun.
Ben suggests exhuming Danny Glick. Matt says he needs to research Barlow and Straker. We cut to Mark going down and researching the Barlow house. He runs into Matt and they're both locked in the Rancor pit, which is what I took it as. This seems like Matt is the actual main character of this reboot, right, Matt? This is what you mentioned?
Yeah, it's his perspective. And he's, pardon the pun for something that's going to happen later, the driving force. You've seen the movie, you know what the fuck I'm talking about.
Yep, we're getting there. We see Barlow start to make his way out as the light is turned on, and Barlow appears right behind Matt, which I thought was a great shot, actually. I kind of like this shot. Dr. Cody gets with Ben and Susan as Danny's mom wakes up, and she's looking like Barbara and Adam Maitland in this sheet. The cross breaks and the sheet attacks. Cody stabs her in the face, and the cross is repaired, and she's taken out in slow motion. I'm sorry, guys. This was bad. I did not like this attack whatsoever.
No argument here.
Is this the one in the tongue compressors?
Yes. Yes.
Yep.
And this is the word where she literally says, oh, hell no. She has the most stereotypical black thing you could do.
Yes.
Yep. So horror movie.
Cody tells Ben to put the cross on her, which exorcises the vampirism from her, I guess.
That's like sucking the poison out of a snake venom bite with your mouth.
It'd be like getting bit by a vampire and taking a rabies shot.
There you go.
I couldn't believe this. I'm like,
I can't either. Ben says he needs to tell Burke that he was right about vampires, but Ben realizes that it's for naught, as Burke is dead. We cut to a tied up and hanging upside down Petrie, who's approached by Straker. As he walks in, Petrie gives him a huge shot in the face with a crowbar. Again!
The fire poker.
The fire poker, yeah. I'm sorry, yeah. Again, this kid, I'm telling you, I wouldn't want to run into this kid in the fucking street. He would murder me.
I like that he stands up for himself.
I do too,
actually.
On
his own. But I do think, I think we either need more kids or... There needs to be, I mean, it seems weird to have this one kid being the only one standing up here and doing all this with these few adults. To redo this, maybe do a kid versus adult version of this, where I guess that makes it a little too much like it. Mm-hmm. But just, I don't know, for him to be the only kid surviving, lasting, doing this, just it with these two, three, feels a little off.
Yeah, this kid's basically like MacGyver.
Yeah.
Yes.
Of surviving vampire, but yeah, also if you do that, you're running into the Lost Boys problem, or you're just aping that.
Meanwhile, the group visit Callahan, who tells them that he's going to need more evidence that vampirism exists within the same world as the power of the church.
Both entities involve blood-sucking parasites who use fear-mongering to get what they want, so. And promises of immortality.
Now, Matt, you know this Callahan character, he appears in the Dark Tower series, too.
Yeah, he's a huge character in the book. Yeah. And both of the, well, more so the 04 adaptation, but yeah, he's barely in this freaking thing. Although this movie has no time for characters, Dr. Jones.
Petrie comes by and says that Burke is now one of the vampires and he needs supplies to go after him. He also says that he had to kill Straker as it was his only way out. So, Matt, at least they took Straker out here.
He gets taken out like a bitch.
Yeah.
That kid is just, he's got no problem just walking up and I mean, this is the most...
Yeah,
this kid might as well be mayor. There is nothing. Deus Ex Matt in this Deus Ex Petrie in this freaking town.
He shows no emotion when things are happening. Like his parents both get killed later on, and he
yes
with
yes.
the coldness of a future serial killer.
Just puts a sheet over him. That's it. They all head to the Marsden house, and Petrie points to where Straker's body is. Great moment for Woodward here as she looks around, and as no one volunteers to go get the body, she says, "Fine, I'll go." More. Creepy lights and crackling growls as Matt attacks. Ben gets him down, apologizes to him, and hits him in the heart with a stake.
Yeah, as long as you get in the vicinity of where the heart is, you can kill the vampire.
Well, they explain that in From Dusk Till Dawn, if you've seen that. We get a rotating shot, and by the way, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on this podcast, I fucking hate these shots. These shots of people standing around in a circle, and the camera decides to just fucking rotate all around them, I fucking hate them. Michael Bay used to do this shit all the fucking time.
Yeah, this is the Bad Boys 2
yes.
Boy shot.
Ugh. Shit just got real shot.
Yeah, you need to have an American flag in the background and some Linkin Park playing to pull this off.
So... We see them in this rotating shot as everyone makes plans to meet at the church at sundown. We cut to days-old newspapers as Cody finds the police chief running away, and he says that he's not giving up, he's surviving. I love that this fucking the police chief is like, fuck this, I'm out of here.
I like how that's actually a fun thing from the original movie they do again.
Yeah, me too.
Smartest person in the town.
Exactly. Susan tells her mom that they have to leave, as she tells Ben he needs to leave too, and says that she's met somebody who she knows will take care of her, the store owner down the way, as she grabs a shotgun and runs at them. So
okay.
This
up,
has to be
things.
Something from the 3-hour version. Like, we don't see this at all.
No, and this also has to reinforce that she is under Barlow's like hypnotism, not necessarily a vampire. Yep. She can walk around in daylight, no problem. She's like the new familiar. Except, familiar. I guess that makes you a redneck where you just carry a shotgun and no one's going to take my daughter. You just if it moves, shoot it.
Oh, great. Like, I think there's a lot of that. Can you imagine just like everybody in the town meeting Barlow and just little by little and realize everybody that Barlow met with eventually succumbs. Like, there's something really cool to be had there.
Yeah, they should have had him hosting, like, town council meetings.
I mean, you can have the shot, but that's a little too needful things. Stay tuned.
Mm-hmm. Wow, good reference, Adam.
Make America vampires again.
Oh, for God's sake. Father Callahan and Mark tell his parents that they need to leave as his dad leaves and Barlow attacks. Barlow says it's sad to see a man's faith fail as Mark runs from the turn school kids and locks himself in. Meanwhile, Ben takes Susan to the church. He refuses to have Cody stake her, and she gets away.
Oh no, this woman I've only known for 2 days. I'm not going to lose her. This is also the problem. We have no idea how much time he's been here.
That's a big issue that I had for later, yeah.
And also we forgot when Mark's dad dies, it's unintentionally funny because I hate this trope in movies where nobody listens to the kid, and he goes outside. Even though everything makes sense, the doorbell conveniently rings and he still goes outside. And then he comes back in the house bleeding out through the neck and he's like, son, like,
it's almost played like a laugh, but it's not supposed to be, but it is. I mean, but yeah, they could have done the passage of time even with seasons. You're in a very season-heavy area of the nation, and you could literally have gone in the spring and be delving into autumn and something was short days and really pass that, done something for that passage of time.
Ben runs for her and they see that there are many, many vampires outside. I actually think this is kind of a cool shot. When he's outside and he's face down and then he turns and he looks up and he sees these vampires around him like zombies. I thought that was a pretty harrowing shot. I liked it.
Good shot. Yeah, it was the trailer money shot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was done well.
Although, Matt, am I the only one who got flashbacks to Return to Salem's Lot at this point with all these vampires running around?
Yeah, I did too.
They go to pick up Mark, who's not home. He left a note saying that he was going to kill Barlow. We cut to Mark, who cuts his hand trying to get in the shop. He walks in and starts exploring it. He's attacked by Danny, who is then staked. Mark gets back with Ben and tells them that they need to find Straker and Barlow before they kill more people.
Even though Straker's been dead.
Yeah.
Forget that.
It should be such an emotional for a friend to kill his other friend, but everything has just been so... such a sprint.
Yes.
You don't even have a moment to feel for Petrie killing Danny here.
Blink if you miss it. They do explain, and I forgot to mention this when Mark is introduced, but Mark is new to the town too, which is a different take than what he was in the book and the other movies.
I mean, there's something there that it seems like they're the only black family in town, but this film's not preoccupied with explaining any of that. And it doesn't need to. Like, I don't need that. But I do need something that Deus Ex Petrie feels something for killing his friend other than, I told him I would.
Yeah, there's, we've mentioned this, but there's no emotional attachment whatsoever while watching this film. Like, it's just going by.
It's a sociopath.
Yeah, no, exactly.
No emotion whatsoever.
Put that on the poster. Ben sees that there are no more cars in town, and a mission is made to make more stakes. They find that the cars in the lot are coffins. You know, at first I was against this, but we've seen them go to the Marsden house before. I like the fact that they chose something different. We introduced this drive-in earlier in the film. We're going to have what we think is the climax here. It won't be the climax, but I kind of like that they go here.
I thought this was actually a creative wraparound to bring the drive-through back in, because I'm like, where else could they all hide outside of them just being in their homes? And I thought this was actually clever. My only question is, okay, so all of them just happened to be at the drive-thru as vampire? Drive-in as vampires? He got them all in one shot?
Yeah, and are there child locks in trunks in the 70s? I don't know.
No.
I don't think so. Yeah.
There were no safety standards in the 70s.
Yeah.
So it was like, what, 10 minutes earlier, we returned to the house. And I'm like, okay, here we go. Here's the finale. Because, sure, let's return to the house. You know, we did that in the other ones. I thought we were just going to get a retread. So when we got here, I'm like, did we really? And then it starts, I'm like, huh, all these cars are here. And it took me about 5 seconds longer than it should have, and I'm kind of embarrassed by that. I like this change, though. It's smart. Mm-hmm. It's slick. And at first, I'm like, those aren't going to keep out the light. How stupid is it? They open it, they're covered in a blanket. So they literally thought it through. If you're going to change it up, find a way to do it. And hey, you brought it back. You got these cars. And the drive-in feels something very King about all these cars being in a dusty drive-in. You know, it feels very period. And yeah, I like it. It was a swerve I wasn't expecting, and good job.
Ben sees Susan in a trunk, and Cody tries convincing him that it's not Susan anymore. And this is a beat we've seen, you know, in other iterations, and of course in the book as well. Ben has to kill Susan.
There is Cody. Zool.
I like the way that they do their eyes.
Yeah,
you know,
me too.
You know, it's like a cataracts thing, you know, but it's a completely open iris pupil, so there's just that, you know, shiny look to it, and then you see that light go out. It's a creative way to do it.
Cody is shot by Anne, who appears in the cemetery hunting for Ben. The shadows appear over the cars as trunks slowly start to open, as well as fang-laden mouths. You know, we had that real close-up of that mouth that opens, you know, which I thought was kind of cheesy.
Yeah, I thought they were going to do the Blade 2 thing where you've got, like, mandibles that open up.
Me too, yeah.
I was waiting for it because it started to zoom in on the face.
Ben holds off the attacking vampires as Mark...
But no, before then. Okay.
Okay.
Apparently shade and sundown is the exact same thing. Okay, whatever. Vampires aren't supposed to come out till the sun goes down. This is the fastest moving line of shade slash sun that I have ever seen. When you're outside, when you can physically watch the sun going down and watch that line of I understand it's supposed to be a ticking clock, but it's comical in watching this line of darkness move across this field.
No, it's literally the ending of Hocus Pocus in reverse.
A movie I still haven't seen. Ben, I can't believe I'm about ready to say this. Ben holds off the attacking vampires as Mark drives through the stakes on the drive-in screen, releasing the sun and causing all the vampires to go up in flames.
Because one drive-in screen casts a big enough shadow that all the vampires in the town hide.
This fucking kid, man, I fear for him. I worry about him later on in life. He's doing all of this.
You know what? He's Scud from Blade 2. You think he's... Nah, he's going to end up ruling the roost.
Matt, what do you think about this ridiculous inclusion?
Something I would have seen in Fast and Furious.
Fast and Furious, the 70s edition?
He literally does the spin move from Tokyo Drift to knock down this theater on the screen.
It had already been established that, you know, sunlight will kill a vampire, because we saw that earlier. So when they go here, and when all these cars are bathed in sunlight, they don't need to stake anybody. Just open the trunks, and you kill everybody.
Yeah, I was going to say, just go around, one by one, count to three, wait, open it up, do ding-dong ditch, or you just run away.
Literally, it's all it's credits.
I cannot believe this is where they went with this. And also, what's weird about it, too...
It's actually pretty creative, all things considered.
It is, yeah. But to have the kid do it is just funny to me.
This might as well be an 80s movie where the kid does everything. Like, if you swap him out from Macaulay Culkin, this is Home Alone with vampires.
That's a good point. But the other thing about this, too, that's distracting to me, the fucking CGI with this fire is fucking awful.
Oh, it looks like an Instagram effect.
It looks terrible. If I were to see this in theaters, I'd be pissed. I paid to see these effects on the screen.
Yeah, and also, TV has much better effects than this, too.
So yes!
There's literally no excuse.
We've complimented the makeup effects. I think the makeup in this is pretty decent, but yeah, these visual effects are just not good at all. Meanwhile, Anne is on the warpath until Mike takes her out with the car, Meet Joe Black style. See, he's running down people who are alive, people. This is not a vampire he's running down. This is a real-life person, and he just bowls her over.
Yeah, how is it that the non-vampire has a bigger bloodlust than Barlow? Because now this kid has just become the Punisher.
The Punisher. They both know that they are not okay, as they have to go get Barlow before the sun goes down. They find his coffin, and Ben leaves to get a crowbar, but it's too late as the shadows drape the coffin and Barlow is released. Susan attacks Ben again, and he just kicks her away. Mark sees Barlow as he ducks down, and Barlow attacks. Ben makes a stake out of a table leg and then stakes Susan. He goes back, and just as Barlow is about to get Mark, Ben stakes him as well. There's a weird shot of Ben through the back of Barlow's head.
Yeah, it's perfectly in sync with the hole.
He does not just stake him. He stakes him from the back of the head through the mouth.
Yep.
The stake comes out. He literally sticks it through his mouth. And when he pulls it out, you get that perfect shot of it. It's a choice.
It looks like the scene from Shawshank when they're all looking through the hole he dug.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it does. It really does.
That's a good point. Mark asks if they're all dead, and Ben responds with, yeah. When asked what they do now, Ben just says they make their escape. I guess I like this better than the wraparound let's go hunting vampire scene from the first film. I don't know. I thought this was a decent enough ending.
It's decent enough. My problem is I sat through the credits waiting for the wraparound scene. Because...
Because you knew it was coming, right?
I'm like, well, Susan's not coming back. What are they going to... Who is coming back? Nope.
Well, they just don't. You gotta remember, only sometimes they come back.
Matt's on a roll in this podcast. They drive away as sundown is once again playing. The Jerusalem's Lot sign is in full view and credits roll on Salem's Lot 2024. All right, boys. 2-3 years in waiting. This is our movie. Scale of 1 to 10. Was it worth the experience? Adam.
You know, there was another movie that sat around a couple years after it was done that Garrett was pretty harsh on, called New Mutants a few years ago. And it's about time for payback. So, no, I'm kidding. I could see why this didn't release in theaters. There's a lot going on right now, but this sat around so long that there were a number of points you could have put it out. I don't know if after the big successes that Stephen King and WB had with It, It 2, Dr. Sleep, I think this could have maybe not tarnished, but just not lived up to what they had been doing recently with some of the King adaptations. So I understand it. This is not the Salem's Lot slow burn that we got in Salem's Lot, Return to Salem's Lot, Salem's Lot, but this is Salem's Lot. And this is a version of this movie for today, and it doesn't take its time to breathe. It doesn't take its time to know the characters other than some exposition drops. We get more glimpses of Ben on the back of books than we get explanations of what Ben is there to do, and that's problematic if you want to care about the characters. If you're here to see vampires get steak and kids kill vampires in ways that should be beyond their means, then this is the movie for you. It's a weird adaptation, though, because it doesn't really live up to the original. It does try to carve its own path, but it slavishly recreates some of the original and some things it does well, some things it doesn't. Look, it's on HBO Max. I suggest if you like the originals or even if you like a vampire movie, give it a shot and see it. But I think the soul is still buried somewhere under the Marston house, because there's a lot that could have been done here to really bring out a sense of dread and evil. And even, you know, they did a show recently, Chapel Week, with Adrian Brody, that from what I understand delved into this a whole heck of a lot better. So they either need to leave this town alone or fully do it. But Salem's Lot 2024, or I guess 2021, 2, 3, 4, it's a decent enough time, and for under 2 hours, sure, put it on this holiday season, this Halloween season, and enjoy it. But I'm going to be generous and give it a 6, because it still ran under 2 hours. It has some creative kills, and Alfred Woodard was still she made me laugh every time she popped up and mouthed off. So I'm going to be nice and give it a 6, because I enjoyed this more than some of the others.
6 out of 10 from our resident non-King fan. Matt, what do you say, sir?
You know, I kind of went into this not knowing what to expect, and when you have something that's been shelved as long as this has been, I have a tendency to think of the worst, and thankfully it wasn't that. I found some enjoyment in viewing this, but it's such a frantic pace that I think it loses the essence of what fans of the book or even the miniseries have, is that there's really next to no characterization or real foreboding dread that something awful is going to plague this town. And because of that, it just feels like a straightforward studio horror film. It's not terrible by any means, but I don't think it's great. Would I ever watch it again? That remains to be seen. Some of the cinematography I think is really good, but as a horror film, I got a couple of chilling moments, but a lot of the big things I just couldn't help but laugh at due to how some of it is structured, and a lot of the dialogue in this is pretty cringeworthy. But as something that I watched on a Saturday night with a couple beers, I didn't hate my existence. So in the pantheon of Stephen King adaptations we've covered, I don't think this is near the bottom, but I don't think it's really near the top. It's right in the middle, so I'm going to give it a 5.
5 out of 10 from Goudreau. You know, I think the three of us have been spoiled, because if we hadn't covered those movies a couple years ago, and let's say we weren't doing Stephen King and we just out of the blue decided, let's review Salem's Lot, I would have been curious to know Adam's response, because Adam has been educated at this point. We've sat through two other versions of this, and we all decided that while 79 was decent with the mood and 2004 was okay with the story, they still haven't nailed down what exactly makes Salem's Lot tick. And I don't think this version does either. Now, maybe when the 3-hour version comes out You know I will be there. I will watch that version and I will compare and contrast. But what this movie did for me is justify people saying, well, why do all movies have to be over 2 hours? Well, there's reasons. When you have a book like this, you have characters like this, you need to expand on them. And what this movie does is it does what is commercially acceptable, where they just say, all people want are vampires, let's just get to those. Which is fine. We've discussed all the vampire movies that this was inspired by. And also, since 1979, as Matt has mentioned, we have had a ton of vampires in movies and books and TV shows. So this is not new anymore. And I think somebody coming in and just wanting to watch, oh, that Stephen King thing, it was just made, I'll turn that on. I think they will get some joy out of this. But for people like us who have been through, we know these characters. I have read the book a couple times. I know these characters through and through as well. They're not going to get too much out of seeing these actors go through the motions. And I do think that's what these actors are doing. They're kind of going through the motions. Now, they've changed Petrie up. We've talked about it. We've joked about it. They do enough different things to make this kind of stand out, but still, this is that first movie on Ritalin. It just goes and goes and goes and goes and goes. And by the end, I was unfulfilled. There's some decent kills. I think this movie, if it gets anything right, it's the set pieces, the aesthetics of it. But this was not a really fun watch for me. So I land on the exact same score Matt did. I'm on a 5. I think of the versions I've watched, I still hold 79 above and beyond just because it has better moments. And 2004 is a little below 79, and this is below 2004 for me. So that's how I rank these Sam's Lot movies. And Return of Sam's Lot, as I mentioned, it's its own thing, so I'm not even going to rank that. Matt, would you agree that this, out of the three versions we've watched, this is kind of the least of them all?
I would say yes, just because it's the most, there's not a lot of blood left in that stone. Like, this one definitely has the least amount of what I would consider complex storytelling.
Adam, same. Would you rank this the bottom, or would you rank it higher?
Yeah, I'd probably rank it just below the original. I don't care for Returns. I don't care for Rob Lowe's version of it. But I don't think any of these have done a great job. But in the way of what it does, I think I'd rank it just below the original, which at least had some sweet atmosphere and potential. But like, the potential of this one too, you're not there yet, but you've done so many, you need to back away.
All right, well, we're not going to back away from Stephen King. These two, along with me, are going through a lot of corn. We have some corn movies to get through, two a week, as we've mentioned before. By next year, though, we're going to get to a lot of the sentimental stuff that people gravitate towards. We're going to get to The Running Man. We're going to get to Cujo. We're going to get to The Dead Zone. All the movies that I really grew up loving and gravitating towards when I was becoming a fan. So more Stephen King coming up after you get through the Children of the Corn movies. I guarantee there will be better King. But we have more than Stephen King coming up. We have a holiday-themed set of shows that I don't want to reveal just yet. And some more good things to close out the year. So thanks everybody for listening, and until next week, a good podcaster illuminates truth. Thank you, boys.
There's a presence in that house. I don't know if you can feel it.
Oh, I can feel it.
I felt it before when I was a boy, and I went inside. I thought it was me. I thought it was some manifestation of my own fear.
It wasn't.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast.
I'll never forget it.
Please join us next week for an entirely new review.
Evil comes from inside of all of us.
And if you'd like to hear the boys talk about the film adaptations of Carrie and The Shining, please head over to www.bingemedia.net and click the Aftertaste tab.
They were very close friends.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment to give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice. It truly helps others to find and discover these podcasts.
This is a good town, a good community.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
You're sure it wasn't a dream?
Edited by Garrett.
I didn't do anything wrong.
Voiceovers by Adam.
If we burn them out, they'll have nowhere to hide.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Nothing to sink your teeth into.
See you around, neighbor.
Around what?
Yeah, around. You and I can have long discussions. We'll have heated debates deep into the night.
But I thought the trailer looked competent. I thought it was interesting, and it had some spooky vibes to it, though some of the shots and mist made me think of the remake of, what was the one they did recently with Night Shift? Or is it Night Shift? Well, the one with Colin Farrell. Vampires.
Oh.
Fright Night.
Fright Night. Some of the shots made me think of Fright Night.
Well, one's got coming out next year, The Monkey Man or whatever it's called.
Oh, yep. That looks... Oh, God, I saw the trailer for that. Oh, fuck. I can't wait for that, actually. I'm pretty excited because that story scared the shit out of me as a kid.
What the fuck is that called?
The Monkey, right?
That's really what
it's
called?
I think. Yep.
Yeah.
Saw the thing. It looks like the toy from...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, it's called The Monkey. Yeah. That looks
like a Monkey Shines Monkey.
Someone tell the bar owner to pay their electric bill.
I know.
They're literally only lighting half of the bar.
I know. Boy, your devices are making all kinds of noise today, Matt. Everything okay?
That's what happens when people text you.
That's why I turn my sound off. Burke says he'll take... We see Barlow start to make his way out as the light is turned on, and Barlow appears right behind Matt, which I thought was a great shot, actually. I kind of like this shot.
Mark. Sorry. You keep saying Matt. Mark.
Yeah, but Matt's the teacher.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Stop confusing me, Adam. Doctor.
He shows no emotion when things are happening. Like, his parents both get killed later on, and he accepts
it with
the coldness of a future serial killer.
Just puts a sheet over him, that's it.
Kid's going to show up in the next Star Wars movie and be able to do everything.
Well, with Petria, half expecting Sarah and Littlefoot to show up at one point.
head to the Marsden house.
Those of you who are under 20 will not understand that reference.
No.
Most of you who are 30 will understand.
Ben gets him down, apologizes to him, and hits him in the heart with a stake.
Yeah, as long as you get in the vicinity of where the heart is, you can kill the vampire.
Well, they explain that in From Dusk Till Dawn, if you've seen that. Like, once they become vampires...
That's not the movie I want to eat.
Oh, okay.
That movie sucked.
Well,
me and Adam saw that in theaters. I have a very emotional affinity for that movie. For different reasons.
We went to that movie not knowing that it had vampires in it till the vampires showed up.
Yep. Yeah, we both didn't know.
Me.
Nope.
I thought the TV show was better than the movie.
We get a rotating shot. And by the way, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on this podcast. I fucking hate these shots. These shots of people standing around in a circle and the camera decides to just fucking rotate all around them. I fucking hate them. Michael Bay used to do this shit all the fucking time.
Yeah, this is the Bad Boys 2
shot.
Shit just got real shot.
Yeah, you need to have an American flag in the background and some Linkin Park playing to pull this off.
Linkin Park went for Bad Boys 7. Wasn't around in the 70s. It would have been like Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Have you heard that new chick singer, by the way?
Yeah,
it's not bad.
Yeah, she's pretty good. She's no Lizzie Hale, but she's good.
Mm. Oh God! I knew I shouldn't have said anything. I'm not saying it.
Should have gotten Amy Lee.
Oh, she was just here in town. She was at her and Evanescence were at the Nugget the other day.
Yeah, that's why they did. She got the rights back to Evanescence, so she's not falling anymore. Yeah,
There you go. So